Well, this week on Trappin' Radio, this is Jeff Dunlap. I'm here with Nick Ernie, and he's the proud owner of the RBG, the Realm Body Grip Trap Company. We're at the Indiana Convention. So, well, thanks for doing this interview, Nick.
Thanks for asking me, Jeff.
How did you end up buying the RBG company? I mean, I imagine when you were a little kid growing up, you weren't thinking, you know what, I think I'm going to, make round body grips for a living, so.
Right. It was actually at an Indiana State Convention, probably 4 or 5 years ago. I'd spoke to Bill about him selling the company and just kind of kept it in the back of my mind. I was pretty busy running my other business and doing some other work and knew I couldn't really handle it on my own. And then about 2 years ago, my dad kind of semi-retired, and he was in metal fabrication there for almost 40 years. So he was looking for something to kind of fill his time, and I really thought a lot of the product because I was running them, and it all kind of come together.
They're really nice traps, and like at the conventions and stuff, when you're at around Nick's booth, there's always like a buzz, the guys looking at them. They're, a lot of them grew up using the square traps, it's different, to a lot of guys, and there's a lot of interest in them. And I used them, last spring for the first time, and what I liked about them is they don't seem to catch the leaves, especially like, with all the, you're getting a high water and stuff, and the round ones just don't seem to catch the debris that like all the square ones. So I really like that. And I will say the first one I ever set, I caught an otter in. So, I mean, I know you can't make that guarantee every time, they definitely are nice traps. And then you got out, the big talk of the town is the 1022.
Yeah. I had about a year in testing and developing that trap, trying to figure out how big a rod I needed to use and how wide I could make it and still make something that's extremely well built and take the everyday abuse that a beaver trapper puts his equipment into. They work, and they work really well. They're moving pretty well for me and starting to get them in dealers' hands. And I think it's just going to be another tool in a guy's bag. It's not one of those traps that everybody needs 5 dozen of, but I kind of want it like a vehicle, 2 in every garage, because I really do see the use for them.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're trapping otters, I mean, they block down a lot of water.
Right.
And especially like if you did I would say a tire, because I did that set down in Louisiana a bunch where there'd be some old tires laying there, and I'd haul a couple of them on the middle and break that stream.
Right.
And a lot of times it was still big on the size, but you put them 1022s, in a spot like that. But it's like, just so you people that don't know what 1022 is, it's a conibear, it's square, but I guess we call it body grip so we don't get sued, but
yeah.
But they're 10 inches tall and 22 inches wide, and that's what hence the 1022.
Yeah, it just kind of fell in that way, and most outdoorsmen are familiar with the 1022 name, so it was kind of catchy when it all come together.
Yeah.
It's really taken off. I really like it.
But if a lot of you guys haven't seen it, it's like me and Nick was talking, everybody stops by and looks at him. If he just charged $1 to touch the trap, you'd make him big money there.
Right.
But it's just a big, big piece of hardware laying there, and everybody wants to look at it. It's a pretty cool trap.
Right, right.
But the question I get a lot of times is, because like with a square trap, you can put them right on the bottom and they'll set, and you can stake them down. But the question I always get when people are asking me about them on Facebook and other stuff, how do you get them so that they don't, like roll back and forth? You use them
right.
Just with a stand or?
That's probably the number one question I get, besides just a generic question, why are they better? But the answer to that question is, I do build stabilizers for them. A lot of guys like to run stabilizers. I'm not a big fan of stabilizers. It's just more weight in my truck or more weight I'm carrying. most people, when they use sticks or metal stakes or what have you and stabilizing their trap, they put it in like a A shape or upside down V at the top. And I do mine the opposite way, so it would look like a V sitting there, or I run it in the spring and kind of down the edge of the jaws, and it stabilizes the trap and it also leaves the top open. It's more of a, I think animals get blocking shy, and I don't really know why, but I've done that ever since I've stabilized my traps that way. I don't really know who taught me or where I seen it. It's just something I've done. I'm not going to claim that I came up with it, but it's just something I've done.
Claim you didn't come up with it.
No, I'm not going to claim that, because there's a lot of people do it. It's just, that's the way I learned how to do it, so it never was an issue to me. It was just second nature. That's how you stabilize body grips.
So you're just setting it on the bottom just like you would a square one. And then you're running through the jaws right through the spring like an X.
Yeah.
On the top.
Right.
Yeah.
But the X is, you know, on the bottom. It looked like a V.
You're going backwards.
Yes.
Instead of having it where it'd be like a dive, you're having it go just underneath.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I understand that.
I do a lot of beaver trapping, so I've kind of learned that animals get blocking shy as well as square shy. And I don't use a lot of dive stick if I don't have to. Some places you need something to make them really dive down. But a lot of times if I can get by with a couple cattails or a small twig, you know, like the size of my thumb, that's all I'll use for a dive stick. And really seems to work, and they don't seem to notice that stuff quite as much. Definitely feel like it ups my catch.
I think a lot of times you definitely have to have dive sticks a lot of times in position, but I think a lot of times if you don't have it set up right, that them otters are so used to, they don't, everybody assumes they go down, but I think a lot of times they just crawl right over the top.
Yeah, definitely on otter. Actually, when I give my demos, I talk about that a lot, because if you've ever had the chance to watch an otter in a wild or go to the zoo and watch them, you know, take your family to the zoo and use this as an excuse to learn how to kill otter. But, you know, just watch the way.
Well, maybe don't say it.
Yeah. But they'll run, jump, twist around. They're not, you know, like a typical animal that takes a stride. They're bouncing all over the place. And even when they're swimming, they're bobbing up and down. And just little stuff can really influence your otter catch. Just a certain stick in a certain place can make all the difference in the world when it comes to catching otter. I've spent the last several years in Mississippi in the month of February, and that's where I really got to learn how to trap them and trap them well. Because at home, we're only allowed two a year. So most of the time I catch those accidentally in beaver sets before I ever get a chance to target them. That's just kind of the nature of the beast. But anytime I can see an animal in the wild that's not being chased or spooked or something, I always stop and watch it, because you can learn more by spending 15 minutes watching an animal than you can learn in a year trying to trap them.
Because like in Michigan, you know, I caught otter up there and, you know, thought that, you know, I knew how to trap otter. It wasn't until I would go to Alabama or something like that trapping. I was trapping beaver, but, you know, you're catching otter and, you know, you'd see someplace you'd say. But until I really started concentrating on going down to Louisiana and trying to beat on the otters, the thing was going down there is like hammering them in the area and then go back. And see how their travel patterns changed and what they were doing was different. And from when I got there to 5 years later, it was, in a lot of spots, it was totally different. They were cutting corners they weren't any ever before. So, you know, but the thing is, you know, the more pressure you put on something, I think the more you got to do stuff like you're talking about, like, you know, pinning underneath and, you know, changing stuff up.
I've done some stuff down in Mississippi just because of their laws that's legal down there that we're not allowed to do at home in my home state. And you would be surprised what just the fewer lax regulations can really do for your catch. I mean, not having to have stuff fully submerged and, you know, a 48-hour check and different things like that. I mean, you can really, really up your catch whenever you get a little bit more lax regulations and really give you a chance to learn something about them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know, like, when I go to Louisiana, you know, and basically, you know, unless something's changed from when I was down there, you know, a few years ago. I mean, you know, you couldn't use teeth and, you know, you had a 24-hour check. You know, pretty much other than that, it was wide open.
Right.
And, you know, like in Alaska, you know, basically there was, you know, you had to buy a trapping license. You know, I mean, so, yeah. You know, I mean, it's nice to go when you got the regulations like in Michigan or, you know, we only catch, you know, one bobcat, you know, and two otters where I'm at, you know, where you can only catch two where you're at. It's nice to be able to go to, like, one of them southern states or somewhere like that and just give it until your heart can't
right.
go. You know, you're only limited by the amount of willpower that you have to keep going.
Right, or how heavy of springs you got on your truck. I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah.
You know, I went down there the first 2 years, I guess, with a friend of mine invited me to go along with him before I found my own leases down there. And the amount of beaver down there, I really think if there's a sizable puddle of water in the Walmart parking lot, that the beaver would probably build a lodge in it. I mean, they're just that thick down there. And that's the biggest thing I found with otter trapping in Mississippi is you have to clean the beaver out before you can really focus on the otter because they're plugging your sets up daily.
Yeah.
And the weather change, they're so affected by the weather, it's not even funny. I mean, if you got a cold front coming in and you're in Mississippi, you better have everything working because you're going to be skinning the next day.
Hmm. See, like over in Louisiana, if it got so cold enough where it snowed and stuff, it was just like, it would just die. The only thing that would move with them, the cats would move. Because there was ice one time down there, and I walked on the ice in Louisiana, and I was going to look for air bubbles and stuff, and there wasn't any. And I couldn't believe it, because like up home, if we get ice, there'll be, you know, there'll be rat bubbles, there'll be the beaver, you know, but there was nothing.
I'm pretty deep south in Mississippi. I'm like 30 minutes from the Louisiana border going south, something like that, 40 minutes. So I've only seen snow down there once, and that was in middle Mississippi. Just your general cool front coming through. If you know, if it's beautiful weather, highs 65 or 60 during the day, and it's getting down to 30 at night, and you're thinking, this is the greatest thing in the world, I'm not at home fighting mud or ice or snow or whatever we have at home, and you're down there just enjoying it, well, generally your trapping's not very good. It's the fronts down there really make a big difference, I've found.
Yeah, well, definitely the fronts coming through there, and then you know, like the water fluctuations,
right,
and you know, all that stuff, you
right.
know, really plays in.
That's just like the cats. If you get a misty night down there, man, you will have cats the next day. That's just how it is.
And it's awesome to be down there, you know, pounding on them cats. I'm thinking, man, am I glad I'm not in Michigan?
Yeah. Or in Indiana where you got to turn them loose.
Yeah, because, you know, then they were going for, you know, I was averaging $90 to $125 on them cats, you know.
Right.
And, you know, the price might be significantly lower these days. But
yeah, it's not a really desired cat, but I tan most of my own cats or have them tanned, and I'll sell them at my booth or it. Hang them in my shop or use them for decoration or whatever the case may be.
But you know what? Honest to God, if I was down there and had a $30 cat in my trap, or if I was out in Colorado and had a $1,200 cat, I would be just as happy. And, I mean, afterwards, I'd rather have the Colorado cat.
Right.
But when I walk up there, the blood's pumping just as much. I'm looking for that, see if I got a back foot catch where they're going to jump out of my trap.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than walking up and getting your phone out to take a picture and that last lunge, it gets free.
No, I definitely know that if you're using an offset trap, Bridger number two, and you got a back foot catch, dispatch immediately.
Yeah.
So how did, in the, like in the beginning, you know, like now you're doing the RBGs, you know, you're, you know, well, like you're doing the RBGs, but you, when you go down to Mississippi, you're talking, you do the live market down there too.
Yeah, we run the live market down there, and you know, say 6-7 years ago, whenever that was, and fur was doing really good, we didn't necessarily chase them coyotes real hard down there. It was part of the reason we was there, but we was allowed to basically kill anything but a deer or a turkey. That's kind of the rule down south. They want everything going except a deer or a turkey. And we was chasing the cats and otters hard because we was getting really good money out of them. Well, the market's changed, and now we can, you know, got an unlimited market down there on these live coyotes. So that's what we really change, and you really got to work your gear different if you're live market trapping versus the fur market end of it. Just on your snares, your footholds, it's everything's got to be kind of built a little bit different. So that's the biggest thing on it, but I really enjoy it because a coyote is probably my least favorite animal to skin. So if I don't have to skin them, that just makes my life so much better.
And especially down there with all, they're all ticky and, yeah, you know, they've got 30 ticks around the ears and mouth. And
you know, they'll have some hair, but no guard hairs. And
no.
Seems like about every...
More of a trim coyote.
Yeah. That'd be a good way to put it. But I really enjoy the live market. It's just something different I don't get to do anywhere else, and it's fun. I enjoy it.
I never done it before. Had lots of invites, like, you know, go down to Chips and do it, and I want to go down there and do it, you know, sometime. It's just, you can't do everything, and,
right.
You know, like last year, I'd rather go to Alaska than, you know, do live market coyotes, so.
Right.
But, you know, I'd like to do it just to, you know, say I did it, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of guys that make good money, you know, and have, you know, second income doing it down there.
Right, absolutely. If you can, you know, get on the coyotes, and when we're there in February, they're a little bit tougher to catch, I would say. I keep threatening to go down there, like, middle of November, but that's when their deer gun season starts, so I don't want to make my farmers and lease owners mad about me riding around catching coyotes while they're trying to kill deer, but I think there's a...
You wouldn't have to worry about going back the next February.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They'd probably tell me to go somewhere else.
Yeah, there'd be a... you're out of business. Well, you always go to Louisiana and trap the federal ground down by Pollock. You know, they're really friendly there.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I've been thinking about trying that. I'm looking for a partner, though, kind of ride shotgun, so to speak.
That'd be like the suicide trap line. for prices are down. I'm going to go set some traps by Pollock.
That might be my my final trip out of state. I'll go try that.
Well, they didn't say they wouldn't bury you. So, it'd probably be like a Billy the Kid tuner where you're laying there and they kick some dirt on you.
But. Right. But no, there is extra added work involved in the live market because you got to have pens, good solid pens, because there's nothing more aggravating than getting up one morning and seeing some coyotes cut out of your pen.
Yeah.
But like I said, the traps are different. We inside, outside, laminate everything.
Because they're real, real picky on the feet.
Yeah.
If they got any damage at all, they don't want them. Mostly, right. They're probably like every other market. You know, if the more they got, you know.
Right. The harder more they picky grade them. Right.
You know, but like the coon market.
Yeah. Just it's like the fur market. Yeah. Right. Exactly. We short chain everything, shock springs, and. This is kind of on a different subject, but the people that tell you rubber jaws is the way to go have clearly never used rubber jaws. We ran them. I still have a couple to appease some landowners at home, and I will not run them on the live market. They cause way more damage than a steel jaw offset, you know, laminated jaw ever will. And a lot of them I sold or either laminated them and turned them into just regular gel traps.
Probably that's about like most things that the government comes up with.
Right, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. Let somebody sitting behind the desk make your rules, and that's what happens.
Yeah.
Which is really great that Tennessee got away from that.
Yeah. Yeah, John Daniels and that whole, it wasn't just John. you know, but that whole group of guys, that was pretty awesome.
Right.
You know, with if they'd have said, told us the year before in private that they were going to do that, I'd have been like, yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good luck.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. Because it seems like anymore you never see trapping regulations get better for the trapper.
No.
I'm an avid houndsman myself. That's kind of what got me back into trapping. I trapped when I was a kid, but I coon hunt a lot, and I was standing one night.
Whoa, whoa, interview over. We're gonna have to do a what would they call that, exorcism. I'm just kidding for everybody out there. I used to run dogs myself.
I was standing in water one night over my knees because the beaver had one of my really good spots backed up, and the guy I was with, I vowed to him that I would kill these beaver in not so many words, but that's kind of what got me back into trapping, and it really took off from there.
I think probably a lot of the coon hunters, you know, they did it when, you know, not all, but like me, you know, when I was younger, I'd want to be out, you know, out at night. Now I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be out there lost in the swamp in the middle of the
right,
dark.
Right.
I can't see as good at night.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. That's a.
I ain't got no young kid like the guys that took me. You know, right. they had a young kid, which was me. They'd get the climb. Oh, we can't see the coon. Here, take our pistol and climb the tree. And I go up the, you know, my dad didn't know none of this.
Yeah.
But up the tree, I go with the pistol to shoot the coon out. I'm like a 12-year-old kid. I don't know nothing.
Right. You know, the guys that took us, that's when the cheap two-way radios was first getting real popular. So they'd give you a two-way radio and it's like, yeah, go get the dog. You can hear him barking, can't you? And you'd be like, yeah. So then you go get it and.
And it was awesome.
Yeah, and I ate it up. I mean, absolutely loved it. You know, that's kind of what got me into it, is them old guys that I probably would have never got into if it wasn't for them. That's why I try to, whether it's hound hunting or trapping, anytime a kid or anybody, as far as that goes, shows any bit of interest, I try to take them along.
Yeah.
But inevitably, you always have a bad day or a bad night the first time they go. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's on the regulation thing. I mean, it's just one of those deals that we got to fight for what we've got. And just because you're allowed to do something legally doesn't necessarily mean you should do it everywhere. If you're on public ground, you know, don't be throwing 220s in buckets just any and everywhere, especially if it's, you know, a big beagle hunting ground or squirrel dogs through there, stuff like that. You know, just because you can do it don't mean that you should.
Because a lot of times, nothing bad even happens to happen.
Right.
And I'll explain what I mean by that. But nothing bad has to happen, like a dog gets caught or something, for something to be changed. It could just be the potential threat of it. Like in Michigan, they were looking at, the way I was told by a guy up there that's big in Michigan trappers, there were some problems where some guys were running around, because we in Michigan we only had to have a 330, you know, with the bottom jaw is covered, you know, with water, so you could do like a regular, like a lure 330 right. lure set, something like that. Anyway, some guys were running around and putting them in bad spots. DNR found out about it. It's a potential hazard, and
right.
they're looking at changing the laws where we'll have to be. I don't remember, so I'm not even going to say. I don't know if it's going to be. Not like it was, but nothing
right.
even happened. It was the potential threat
right.
that some guys were off doing stuff in spots where they shouldn't have been doing it.
Right.
So, but I'm same as you, you know, where I think we should go and, you know, not bow down and, you know,
right.
change everything and, you know, stand up to them and take ground back. And that's the way that the NTA seems to be going now.
Right. I mean, I live in Indiana. I trap a lot in Kentucky because I'm 30 minutes I can be in Kentucky from my house. And I've been helping lobby some of their laws. They got a different rulemaking system than we got. And the guys from the UTK are really forward thinking on this stuff. And they're really active at being at the state house and all that. And, you know, they did give a little bit. Like in Kentucky, you're only allowed to use a 5x5 on state property, But in return, they got a 72-hour check and a month extension on their beaver season. And they just, sometimes you got to give a little to get a little, but, you know, you got to do it where it's needed. And not having any conflict is kind of the best way I found around that stuff. Because there was a guy at the Kentucky State House walking around with a 660 Super Bear, holding it the wrong way than you would, most people had said it, saying, look at this, this is big enough to catch your little kid, and they're setting these right on dry ground. You know, all he was trying to do was create fear.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got to have the facts, because if you get mad and just fly off the handle at them, that don't help nothing. You got to have facts to throw back in their face, and, you know, good common sense goes a long way in that stuff, which doesn't really sound in politics.
It's not going as far these days as what it used to.
Right, but, you know, that's why you need to join your state organizations or the NTA, the Nationals, just to help fight this stuff, because if you say, well, it's not me, one day it will be.
And, yep.
I mean, we lost our cat season, which I thought was going to be a shoe-in, because our otter season came in just spot-on perfect, hardly any blowback. But
yeah, because like last year was a real heartbreaker with the cats. You know, Ohio didn't get theirs, and right. Indiana didn't get theirs.
And it was all pressure from antis, and our politicians caved into it. It's basically what it amounts to. So whether you're a deer hunter, turkey hunter, coon hunter, it don't matter. If you want the right to harvest these animals or pursue them or, you know, shoot one out of your deer stand or call them, we all got to join forces in this stuff and kind of work together.
Yeah. A lot of times I'll talk to people, and even on Facebook I'll see some stuff that people write, that people puts on there in their writings and say, well, you know, I want to do this for trapping because, you know, trapping's a dying art. And my thing is I never ever look at it like that. I always think we're gaining ground.
Right.
You know, it might be that, I mean, in my life I really don't deal with anybody that's not a trapper. I mean, almost every single person has something to do with trapping or the trapping industry in my whole life. So it's like, to me, everybody does it.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I know exactly where you come from. It can be a 100 degrees in July, and when the phone rings, odds are I'm going to pick it up and talk to somebody about traps or trapping. Yeah, one or the other. Yeah. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. So, and you know, I see all the winds we get, like, what they did down in Tennessee with the rubber jaws. Illinois, I mean, who would ever figure Illinois would come out of the gate with a 5-otter season?
Right.
Or even get it, and then, you know, right away, bang, bang, back to back, they get a bobcat season.
Yeah.
You know,
it definitely made some good stuff to throw in the face of our biologists. It's like, come on, Illinois is doing it.
You know, but I mean, and there's a lot of other wins that aren't mentioned, but, you know, I see, like, we're winning. You know, I guess I got a gold miner mentality too.
Right.
You know, where I always think the next one is the big one. You yeah. know, so
right.
But you know, so I see the positives.
Yeah, it's I think our industry as a whole is changing. The days of guys long line trapping, you know, going out piling up big numbers and stuff like that, those days are dying. Just for the simple fact that, you know, it's tough to even cover your fuel costs anymore.
Yeah.
But the days of, okay, our deer gun season's over, I'm not ready to go sit in the house till turkey season's over, it warms up the fish, or, you know, let's go out to our deer lease or the guy that lets us hunt on his property and let's go try to knock some coyotes back or thin the coons and possums out. And that's more what the industry's coming to. So I think we need to, as trappers, we need to kind of influence those guys more to join our associations and kind of attend some of the stuff instead of them getting on YouTube and watching some wrong videos. There's a lot of right videos on YouTube. Jeff makes some very, very good ones and other guys, but there's some really wrong ones on YouTube too.
I think that, you know, with the trapping, it's more... the only way I can think of put it is more intimate than like deer hunting, because like if you take a kid out there deer hunting, and I mean I grew up deer hunting with my dad,
right,
but the thing is the whole time we sat there, don't fidget, don't talk.
Right.
You know, so you're not interacting with them. All I did was get in trouble the whole time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But you know, when I went trapping with them, you know, I mean, we had more conversations and stuff.
Right.
So the thing is, you know, if you get them, the dads and mothers out there to, you know, take the kids out and do the trapping, you know, over some, if you had to pick, you know, because resources aren't unlimited. You know, I mean, they go out and spend a day running 12 muskrat traps and have a whole conversation. And
right. I mean, the gentleman that started taking me to Mississippi, or inviting me to go with him there at the beginning, I mean, it was like a competition every day. You know, I was making a set, he was making a set, just good-hearted ribbon fun. And, you know, and I've got a six-year-old boy now. He's been going with me basically since he could walk. I mean, he was going before that, just small stuff, but I can only carry so much for a kid at one time. So he wasn't along a lot then. But now, like his fall breaks and Christmas breaks and Thanksgiving, that's what we plan on doing is, you know, I get caught up in my work and I'll take a week or however long he's off, and that's what we do. You know, that's kind of me and his time, and trying to teach him the ways of the outdoor. And you know, they see so much violence and stuff on TV, and I know that sounds like everybody else preaching out there, mm-hmm. but it's true. And I can see it in kids, I can see it in his friends, I can see it in some of my younger relatives. And, you know, just kind of respecting that animal, and you can just get out there and talk and show them stuff that most people never see or never even realize is out there.
No, because most of the people ain't ever going to see a bobcat up close. And
right.
But yeah, that's the thing is that they think that, there ain't no bobcats around here. But the thing is, they don't know nothing about them.
Right.
But they want to protect them, but, you know, they right. know nothing. You know,
I've got a.
When you get them kids out there and start teaching them the stuff, and
right.
I mean, I'm big with, you know, kids. I mean, I don't talk about it a lot, but you know, I just think that, you know, you got to have them kids excited about, you know, I mean, you got to get that fire going in them.
Right. Right.
That's my whole job is, my grandson Mason, you know. He's gonna have the fire whether he wants it or not.
Yeah.
I don't really care. I'll put the fire in him or on him. I don't care. He's gonna be doing it.
Yeah, that's one thing a lot of older guys have told me about, you know, raising kids or whatever. They said if they want to do it, take them, do as much as they want to do. But they said when they really start getting burnt out, kind of back off a little bit. He said, or you will burn them out. And, you know, they're talking from experience because they've done it with their own kids.
Yeah.
And I know how it is. I was doing some work on a federal refuge deal that no trapping on, but they had to have some beaver work done because stuff was getting out of hand. So
I was hoping this is where it went in, where, yeah, so we didn't go in during the day. We snuck in at night with our night lights. You're such a disappointment to me.
But we was in there. I knew I had to. It was supposed to get really cold and ice up. And where I'm at in southern Indiana, you don't trap beaver through the ice. One, the ice very rarely gets thick enough to where it's truly safe. And two, I just don't like water flying in my face when I'm knocking holes in ice.
Or falling through it,
because it's really cold then. But I was trying to get sets
in. You trappers in southern Indiana are well-trained. I mean, you know when there's ice on, that water's cold.
Yeah.
You guys can't be tricked at all.
I've learned from firsthand experience on that one. But, I mean, I know how I can get to push a kid. I caught myself doing it a couple times last year, but I try to just back off and really let them enjoy it. Like when he was probably 3 years old, I guess, you know, I'd be pounding in a coyote set or dirt hole or whatever I would be. Well, I'm there playing in the dirt with a hammer and a sifter and a knee pad. Well, guess what Lane wants? He wants a hammer, a sifter, and a knee pad. So, which I always did carry two hammers and two sifters just because I have left stuff behind before. So that's, I get his, he goes over to his spot, and he acts like he's putting a set in, playing in the dirt. He's happy, I'm happy. We're catching coyotes, and, you know, we just go on. It's good times.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad had the opposite track. It was I don't care if you want to go. Get in the truck. When I get back, them coon better be scanned out there. So, in being fair, a lot of times they weren't when he got back, or was kind of a shabby work.
Yeah. Well, he's not quite to that age yet, so we'll see how this progresses the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, you get to about 14, 15, and the attitude starts coming on.
Yeah, then it might not be so friendly.
No. Yeah, my dad had it figured out. Just apply pressure. He knew where to put it, too.
That's kind of the way we were raised.
Like when you started trapping, what age did you get in, you know?
The best I can remember, I think I was 7 or 8. And I grew up rural in the country. We live in farm country. And I was box trapping coons just across the field from our house. And caught mostly skunks and possums, but I was catching stuff, and that's what really mattered. And then I'd go explore, and one day I found a 1.5 long spring wired off to a tree that I thought had been long lost, forgotten. Turns out the guy that owned the property had actually set the trap. So I guess in all, actually,
You found an antique new house.
No, I didn't even know what a new house was.
You thought Mountain Man set that trap.
Yeah, I thought this thing had laid there forever. And I picked it up and took it home and probably set it 1,000 times.
So what you're saying is you started your trapping career as a trap thief.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey, everybody's got to start somewhere.
That's kind of how it started.
At least you started where you only could go up.
But, I messed around then, and I done a lot of box trapping then just because, it's 7, 8 years old. You don't really have a lot of strength to do some of the bigger stuff.
No.
And we worked on the farm a lot, and that was kind of my job, keeping coons thinned out of the barns and feed rooms and whatnot. And I had a great uncle that snared coyotes and fence rows, and I was always intrigued by that because he caught a coyote. We just shot him when we got a chance, but that was pretty neat. And then I started into the hound hunting, and that kind of took over. I still box trapped and whatnot to just train dogs with, but didn't really do it for the fur. And then, like I said, the beaver was flooding my coon hunting spots, so I started war on them. That kind of escalated from there.
It's interesting always to hear, everybody's got a story how they started, and it's always interesting to hear, how somebody started. And then it seems like a lot of times with people, they get, and I've talked to people all the time, same as you, where they got into the trapping, at a young age.
Right.
They did it with their parents, or they did it as a teenager, and then they got married, and life happened, and
right.
Then they went away from it, and then now that they're close to retirement, or got a divorce, or got more time on their hands, less money, and, and time on their hands, they get back into, there seems to be a time in somebody, in people's lives when, they move away, but they always come back to it.
And I've seen it a lot in trapping, doing all the shows that I do, and in that hound industry, too. You get kids out there that, growing up, they're constantly hunting. They kind of get to the driver's license, chasing other stuff, and then they kind of get settled down in life and get stuff squared away, and then they come back to it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of had this discussion today. We're working on a program with the state to, recruit more people into the outdoors. And there's another guy brought up a very good point that I never really had thought about until he brought it up. But guys, go through school, graduate, go to college or not, or get a job and get married and have kids and got bills to pay, and you're raising your kids, and when your kids are old enough that they don't want to be with you all the time, then you get time to do this. Well, you missed a prime time in their life to introduce them to a sport. Now all they're going to realize is, well, dad done it, or dad messes with it a little bit, but you never really took them and showed them and tried to introduce them into them. I think that's where a lot of parents in general make a mistake, because you're taking a time when your kids want to be with you and you can be teaching them a lot.
Yeah.
And you're it's making up excuses, but it's really not, because I know how it is. So that's something I think people need to think about a little bit harder and more in depth.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of the kids want to go out and do this stuff if you get them out there. Like, we went out looking for coyote sign. Mitchell and Kayla were, you know, labeling bottles and stuff. And so I took the grandkids, and I wanted to go out and look for coyote signs. We're starting to get, you know, closer to season. I took them out, and I says, we're going to go look for coyote tracks. And so we went out to some, you know, sand pits I trap and stuff like that. And they were excited, and they were running around. And you know, looking for tracks. And Aubrey, she can pick out fox tracks. She has a hard time sometimes, you know, with a smaller coyote track now.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, that's pretty good for seven.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not many grandparents that take the kids to, like, a shooting range sand pit that's full of glass where people shot it and have their grandkids running around looking for coyote tracks with this glass all over.
Right. Right.
But, but you know, the thing is that they loved it, you know. And, you know, it's getting them out there, like, when they're young. I mean, Aubrey's been going with me since, you know, basically she could walk.
Right.
And, you know, she used to sit on selling weasels for, you know, the taxidermists and send them mm-hmm. to my dad when he was up to Alaska, and to sell to the natives up there for their crafts and stuff. And, I'd have them whole in the freezer, and I'd look over there on the couch, and I was like, what the heck she got? And the child look, and she's got two weasels, like, they're fighting each other. And they're like, frozen solid. You know, she's, like, two or 3 years old, you know, playing with these frozen weasels like they're Barbie dolls. You know. But, you know, it matters when the kids are, you know, raised around that stuff.
Right. I mean, that's like when...
And that's the thing is if you miss that point, not that it's too late, it's just, it's ingrained in them.
Right, and then you're fighting for their time over going out with their buddies, doing whatever. You know, that's what I see. Or, you know, by maybe if you wait till you're retired to start trapping, again, your kids might have kids, then they can't spend any time with you. You know, it's...
Because one thing I happened to me, I went to an auction, a guy passed away, and his name was Eric Schultz. And I don't know all of the circumstances with Eric. I know he had passed away. He used to sell fur to my dad. When he was a teenager, he'd come in and sell his fur. And I was talking to a buddy I knew at that auction. And he said that he'd come in to sell fur with my dad. And he'd come in with his, he was going on a date and had his dancing shoes on and everything, selling coon to have enough to take this chick out, you know? So, but, you know, the thing is that Eric lived his whole life. And at the end, I'm standing there at this auction, and I called my daughter from there. I says, do not do this to me. There's all these people that Eric didn't know, and his traps are sitting on this wagon, and people that he don't know and don't care nothing about his stuff was buying that stuff just to sell to somebody else.
Right.
And I told my daughter, I says, do not sell my stuff. I don't care if you give it away. Do not have people come and buy my shit like that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
But that was, it was a sad deal.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, for
but
sure.
But the thing is if you don't have anybody to carry it on, that's what's going to happen to your stuff.
Exactly. You know,
it's going to go somewheres.
Yeah, that's.
And I'd rather have it like three generations instead of just one.
Yeah.
And I know when you're dead, and it doesn't matter, you know.
But
but I'm not dead right now, so.
Yeah. Still thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very prime example that most people can relate with, you know.
Even though I would say that I know that Eric would have smiled when that, air quotes, antique Duke bear trap sold for $650 that would that you could go to F&T and buy for $240.
You shouldn't have told him that. I was going to try to unload some.
That was fake news.
But, yeah, that's... that's the same way with hounds or anything else. I mean, stuff's that away, you know. I'm in my 30s and it's not a legal will, but I've got stuff wrote down in my safe that if something happens tomorrow, my wife knows where everything goes. Just because I don't want to see it just get, you know, sold to somebody else that is going to just sell it for profit.
I just tell them all, Aubrey gets everything. There's three other grandkids, but she'll dish it out evenly, I'm sure. Weasel killing Aubrey. With a name like that, you deserve it all.
But any other questions you got, or
what's, you got any future plans for RBG?
Yeah, I'm always dreaming stuff up, because when you're sitting in the shop welding for hours on end, you're always thinking about ways to speed stuff up or new traps or new things to make. So I'm always thinking there's always going to be something.
All this coming. All this stuff's made, done in house. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it comes in a stick of rod and leaves as a trap. We get, you know, some parts laser cut places, stuff like that, but it's not just assembled.
It's probably way different than what you thought it was going to be.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know,
that's usually how it is.
Yeah.
But I met Nick's the guy that does all the cables. They're on his traps, Dewey, and you can't ask for a nicer guy. And I ribbed him pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know. And most of it we're not going to go into here.
Right.
But that's the thing is, you know, Nick's got good guys working for him, you know, so, you know, and, you know, you can see, I was just talking to Dewey, even though he was taking a lot of abuse, you know, I mean, he does care.
Yeah. Dewey's one of those guys, he was looking for something to kind of fill a void so he wasn't staring out the window so much after he retired, and I think he bit off more than he could chew some days, because you got to send him home early. You can see the fire in his eyes.
Kind of dwindling.
Yeah.
But I met him over there to Little Valley Cat County Convention, and he really did like that, though.
Yeah, that's what, you know, he always helps me pack or sees me go or works the shop when I'm at a convention. And I just one day said, Dewey, you want to go to New York? He said, yeah, I'll go. So he wanted to see it, and he got to see it. You know, it's kind of like Dad. He trapped when he was a kid, never did trap when I was growing up. But he always helped me. If I wanted to do something, he would help, whether or not he wanted to do it. But Dad started going to the National and stuff with me, and he couldn't believe it. It just blew his mind. I guess he thought I was just blowing smoke.
Yeah, I met your dad out there at the National. I got to talk to him a little bit. And
so he's a believer that there's still trappers around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the RBGs, you know, like we talked about, the, you know, for the beaver and the otter, but, you know, you have a wide variety of different, you know, from, you know, little bitty ones.
Yeah, they go anywhere from 2.5 inches in diameter to 12 inches in diameter.
Like a 2.5 inch diameter one, what would that be used for?
Your chipmunks, your little red squirrels,
ooh,
stuff
like
that.
Ooh, I like the sound of the red squirrel.
that's what a lot of them's used for in the nuisance industry. There's a big market out there in the nuisance industry, and those guys, I mean, they're trapping 300 plus days a year, and they got to have top quality equipment that lasts for them, because that's what they're making their living with, and they got to have specialized stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, I can say I trap hard, but let's be real about it. Our season don't come in till October 15th and goes out March the 15th. So if I trap every day, I got like 4 or 5 months there I trapped every day, where these guys are doing it for a living.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we make the 2.5, 3.5, and a 3x3 square trap that's geared towards squirrels, chipmunks, that sort of stuff. A lot of people nail starlings in them where they're trying to go up in your house. You know, there's a neat little bracket that can go on them and works really good. And then, you know, we make the fur size stuff, which is a 4.5 inch, a 5 inch, 6 inch, which is your 160, 220, 280, 330, and the 440, which is the 12 inch. But apparently groundhogs must really be in abundance, because the 6 inch just fits perfect in a groundhog hole. And I get a lot of people send me catch pictures of groundhogs.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's just all the time.
Yeah, the groundhogs seem to be a real problem in a big part of the country. Like I was talking to some guys here in Indiana. They're, you know, just like, they're ADC guys, and they're just going, you know, they don't do nothing but trap groundhogs, they said.
It was, when I was growing up, we had a lot of groundhogs, and it was kind of, you know, Sunday afternoon fun, or in the evening after Dad got off work, we'd, you know, kind of drive around and shoot groundhogs in the bean fields. And then they kind of disappeared, and everybody blamed it on the coyotes. I don't know that we have any less coyotes, but our groundhogs are really coming back. And another weird thing I've noticed is it seems like we're seeing some more gray fox around home. And you talk to some people, and they say the hard gray fox declined when the groundhogs declined because they didn't have places to burrow or to den. So I don't know if there's any correlation in that. I guess time will tell.
Above my pay grade.
Yeah.
After I pass away in heaven, and they have sold all my traps at an auction,
right?
Then I'll know.
That's, the biologist was talking to somebody today, and she said, it's really weird to say, but we've got a wide open season on gray fox, and we probably have more bobcats than gray fox. And there's no probably about it. I know we do. I mean, I have never caught a gray fox in the state of Indiana. Never. I've only seen a handful of them alive cross the road or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And an average season for me, I'll turn loose 6 to 8 cats trying to avoid them.
Hmm.
So it's, yeah, we need to put the gray fox on the protected list and get the bobcats off of it.
I think the CITES tag, you know, is what probably gives them the,
right,
you know,
right,
which I mean, it's like we were talking before, you know, not during this conversation, but before, you know, I mean, these are just look-alike species, you know, they're not endangered, they're not hurt,
right.
You know, the populations are, you know, booming. It's like in Michigan, we got more cats now than we've had to, maybe ever. Because,
right.
I mean, you know, I mean, they're catching them in southern Michigan. You know, like some of the guys caught them in Jackson. You know, Shane caught one in Jackson like 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
You know, and that was the first one I heard about. And, you know, and I mean, now you hear it regularly, you know, guys
right.
in southern Michigan. I mean, they're catching them outside of Detroit area.
Right.
You know.
It's just with all, I mean, look at Fisher, how their range is spreading south. I mean, granted, we don't have Fisher in Indiana. I know very little about them, but it used to be a Northwoods creature. And you go up to Wisconsin, they're all through the farm country
oh,
now
yeah.
in Wisconsin. So I guess it's just the way they adapt to stuff. I don't know. But it's kind of neat.
Oh, yeah.
Pay attention to it.
No, yeah. Because when you're dealing with that stuff with the antis or even the government, it doesn't matter. They're not out there, and they're not catching and releasing and seeing there's cats. Yeah, I caught 2 cats over here. I caught 1 over here.
Right.
You know, all they're thinking is, you know what? I haven't seen one myself when I'm driving down the road.
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
I drive 10 miles to work, and I drive 10 miles down back home, and I've never seen a bobcat. So there can't be that many.
That's right. About
the theory that
right.
they got.
There's a guy that lives right there in the town, my shop, or right outside the town my shop's in. And he comes in, he's a trapper, and he squirrel hunts and with dogs and whatnot, and digs root, and he's just an outdoorsman after he retired. I mean, that's what, he's busy every day, but he's doing something outdoors, whether it's, you know, he might just go cut firewood, but he's always outside. And he told me he caught 7 bobcats before he ever seen the first one just running wild.
Mm-hmm.
He caught, had to release 7 of them out of traps.
Hmm.
So, I mean, but if you tell somebody that has no real world experience or outdoor experience, they don't believe you. They think you're lying.
No. Like, if you take the cats I've caught in traps or run with hounds, and
right.
You take that out of it, I would imagine, I think I've only seen 2, maybe 2 cats. And one of them, I was driving over to F&T's, and when you go down on their dead end road, you know, there's a big dip. And I was going down there, and I seen something crossing the road, but I'm thinking, you know, because it's lower, I'm thinking it's like a deer or something. And I look, I said, holy crap, that's a cat. And I got, you know, I got permission, it was a big cat. And, you know, but I mean, that was, you know, right. one or two that I've seen.
He was probably delivering cat litter headed in your truck, weren't you?
No, I think that there was hellfire over there, and it was calm.
Okay.
But he was heading the other way, so apparently he was scared. Didn't get the hellfire. but you know, I mean, more politics, you know, flow into all that stuff, I think, than...
Oh, absolutely. That was like... You know, I attend a lot of the state meetings when we have hearings and whatnot. And I was at the otter hearing, and I was trapping rats at Goose Pond. That time we was away from home, we was up there for 2 weeks trapping rats on a big state property. We got the draw for. So we go up there, and this guy gets up, and believe it or not, when I walked in, I was like, all right, that guy's on our side just by the way he looked. So he gets up, and he starts his spiel, and I quickly learned that he's not on our side. And he says, places like Goose Pond have never had an otter recorded. There's no sign of them. I go out there nature watching and look at birds, because there's a lot of migratory waterfowl come through there. And he said, I've never seen one. They never had them. I've talked to the naturalist at Goose Pond, and they say they don't have them, which Goose Pond has no naturalists, or at least they didn't at that point in time. But the funny part of it was, that evening or afternoon when we was coming out of the marsh, we was in a channel, and you had to run electric motors up there. You weren't allowed to run gas. And there's an otter bobbing up in front of us as we're coming out. And this guy's, you know, preaching to them how there's no otter at Goose Pond, and they don't know.
No.
I mean, because we was there 2 weeks, and we was spending, you know, 8+ hours a day in the water, and we only seen one. This guy's going out there on a Sunday afternoon for 2 hours watching birds, so the odds of him seeing one's going to be pretty slim.
Again, common sense.
Right.
Doesn't
right. Exactly. Exactly.
But, yeah, I had that happen where somebody was, when you were talking about the otter and the guy had never seen him, I just went down to Louisiana, and I had just got down there. And it was like the first or second spot I pull over on the side of the road is this creek. And I can picture it in my mind. And I get out, go down, make an otter set. And just getting started, I didn't take everything I needed. So I'm back up in the truck. Anyways, the sheriff's department pulls up. And they're generally, you know, nice. And the DNR is always nice, you know, down there. And he says, what are you doing? And I says, trapping otter, you know. No, what are you really doing? I'm like, I'm trapping beaver and otter. He says, I want to know what you're really doing, because there ain't no otter around here. And I says, I'm dumbfounded. I don't know what to say.
Right.
You know, I mean, he thinks I'm up to something. I'm just doing what I'm telling him I'm doing.
Come here, stick your hand in the strap.
Yeah. So I told him, I says, because I'd already been on the other side of the bridge, and somebody had been trapping that area and had thrown two otter carcasses over on the other side of the...
Really?
Yeah, there's two otter carcasses laying on. So I told him, I says, well, if there ain't no otter around here, I don't know where them otter carcasses came from over there. He went over and looked. He said, them are otter carcasses? I says, yeah. He said, I didn't even know we had otter around here.
But I
still don't know what he thought. And I think he still thought I was lying, because I went around the block and was setting some coon traps, and he pulled up and put his lights on and run my license. So he drove away and started thinking, you know what? I think that he was messing with me.
Whatever coons was up there, whatever that was, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
100 years ago.
Yeah, then too, but... I don't live real far off the interstate, and then they put in a new interstate. So I would leave my house, and every bridge going down the interstate, they told me I had to pull into the grass. I wasn't allowed to park on the side to run traps. So I'd get off in the grass, and I'd either over or under the fence they got up, and I was down there making coon sets, and I come up one day and there's state police standing there. That's what I'm doing. I said, catching coons. He said, well, they're not worth any money. I said, well, I still like to catch them. He's like, why would you waste your time on that? And it was kind of funny because I had a fur receipt in my truck where I'd sold some coon at an auction. And I told him, I said, I think it's worth my time. And he liked to flip. He couldn't believe it. He was probably picking up road kills when he was patrolling
there. You should have told him, well, I can't get anybody to, you know, pay me for speeding tickets, so I thought I'd do this. This is my backup plan.
But the fur buyer at home that I've sold to growing up, he always tells a story back in the 70s and whenever, when he was buying, that some of his most reliable customers was the sheriffs and the state police. He said they was picking up every roadkill they could find just because they had extra spending money then. But yeah, people just aren't aware of what we do anymore. And you know, it's our own fault. Trappers grew up being secretive and not telling anything, but those times have changed. And
I don't think the keeping the secrets is anybody's doing that any hardly.
No, absolutely not. Everybody wants to be out there saying they came up with something new. But yeah, it's definitely a different world, but I think it's for the better, truthfully.
Well, I appreciate you doing the interview. You ain't got a website.
No, most.
But you're contemplating getting a Facebook page. So
yeah.
Periodically look for something with RBG Body Grips on Facebook, because at some point he'll do it.
Yeah, I got to get a little bit more technologically advanced, I guess.
Well, if we're waiting on that, you might want to wait a month. And look.
Maybe next year in March after I'm done beaver trapping, and you know, I got 2 weeks for the fields dry out or something.
But anyways, I appreciate doing an interview. But if you want to find Nick, he is on Facebook. If you want to, you know, look up Nick Ernie on there, and if you would go on Dunlap Lures and follow my thing, and also. Join Trap and Talk. Nick's on there too. So, anyways, thanks a lot, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff.